Accepted. Okay. Okay, open up the House Committee on Education for Friday the 13th, 2014. Okay, well, we've got on the agenda today. Actually, the first thing we're going to do is we're going to open a work session on, so the last thing on the agenda is going to be the first, and then we're going to have an informational hearing on student data, and then we're going to have a couple of bills. So I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 2846. If you could read.
Sure. Yeah. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2846 provides that 5 minutes spent by students consuming breakfast is considered instructional time in certain circumstances. It declares an emergency effective July 1st, 2015. The committee has one amendment, the dash ones, that changed 5 minutes to 15 minutes.
Okay. Was there a fiscal on that?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. There's a fiscal, and so the Committee on Ways and Means has asked that it go there. Okay. And the fiscal is on the dais, and it's on OLIS.
Okay. Madam Chair, I move to adopt the dash one amendments to HB 2846, dated February 2nd, 2015.
Okay, Representative Frederick moves the adoption of the dash one amendments to House Bill 2846, dated February 2nd, 2015. Is there any discussion?
The amendment.
Pardon? The amendment. Yeah, the amendment was 15 minutes to, from 5 minutes to 15 minutes. Okay, is there any objection? Okay, if not, the amendments are adopted.
Well, next year. Chair Daugherty, I move HB 2846 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means.
Okay, Representative Frederick moves House Bill 2846 as amended to the floor, the due pass recommendation, and that it be referred to the Joint Ways and Means, Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Is there any discussion? Yes, Representative Springer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I will be voting yes on this bill, and I know that we'll be also looking at it in the Ways and Means Ed Sub. I want to talk about a couple things on the bill that have concerned me. I understand the premise of the bill. I liked the 5 minutes that you initially had in there, and the 15 minutes gives me a little more pause for concern. And if we're talking about 15 minutes a day, we're talking about 5 hours a month, approximately. We're getting close to a school day each month. And when we have one of the shortest years, school years in the nation, and we have one of the highest absenteeism rate, I get concerned about that. So, but I have faith that that time is absolutely going to be used as instructional time, that it isn't just going to be, as I said, roll of milk. There's going to be more engagement there than just that. And so I'm going to trust that that's what's occurring. But we're talking about a significant amount of time as it adds up over the months.
Absolutely. And from what I understand, it's up to 15 minutes. And that it be instruction time is going to be made infinitely clear to all of the school districts once this goes through.
Thank you.
Any other discussion? Okay, seeing none, is there objection? Okay, we have to go aye. Okay, all those in favor of the motion, please say aye.
Aye. Aye. Aye.
Any opposed? Okay, motion carries. And the bill is sent as amended to the Joint Committee on Ways and Means. Thank you very much.
You get to have that measure.
Okay. Okay, with that, I'm going to open up an informational hearing on student data privacy. We have Benjamin Tate and another gentleman. Whose name's not on my script. Okay. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Daugherty. Members of the committee. For the record, my name is Ben Tate. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the Oregon Department of Education. I have asked Mr. Brian Reeder, our research director, to join me as well to cover part of this presentation. I was part of the privacy committee that Representative Frederick chaired last year, and I gave this presentation to that committee. It was very helpful in level setting some of the current federal guidelines that we operate under when it comes to student data, as well as kind of some of the data that we're collecting at the department and the security practices that we take to ensure that that data is safeguarded. And so it's my pleasure to give you that same presentation as we kind of embark on this conversation. Brian, can you hit that for me? Okay. So we're going to cover four main topics today. The first one, thank you. First one we're going to cover is the current laws, FERPA being the big one, but there's other statutes that apply that I want to make sure that everyone is aware of. And then we're also going to cover, at a high level, the data that ODE collects, the data that we don't collect, and then how we handle data sharing and protecting. So first, current laws, and I will just give you a high level of this. I won't read you slides verbatim. COPPA, which is the Children's Online Privacy Protection Act. So COPPA is the one that applies to children under the age of 13, is specifically related to online services. So what this says is there are different rules that apply to these sites. So any site that is marketing to children under this age has to have explicit parental consent, and there are different terms and conditions that these services have to operate under, specifically regarding advertising, data collection, and data storage. They have very distinct rules that are different for those children that are under the age of 13. This applies in the education realm to obviously those tools that we're using at an elementary level. Sorry. As well as middle school. And so this is a consideration for all districts when they're engaging with vendors that are offering online tools and educational services to make sure that these same terms apply.
And these are the things that the kids do in the classroom on their pads? And
correct. Whatever. Yeah, correct. HIPAA, you are probably all very well familiar with. We deal with this only slightly at the department, but the districts do deal with health information related to their students. And so HIPAA is a regulation at the district level that they have to be very well aware of and make sure that they're taking additional safeguards to any of that health-related information and ensuring that the disclosure of that is very, very limited. We also deal with free and reduced lunch information. USDA has very specific guidelines on the collection and disclosure of this data. In fact, the data can only be used for the purpose of administering the program. It's not even allowed to be disclosed for research purposes. So this data is very separate from what we would normally deal with in terms of a student record. So the districts have to manage this data separately, make sure that the disclosure of this is very tightly controlled and only to those that are directly administering the program. And the department, I'll get into our side of this a little later, but we have a very different set of rules around this data as well because of those regulations. And now for the big one in terms of education data, FERPA. I have three different slides on this, so I'll just kind of chunk it up. So specifically on this first slide, I wanted to cover what student and parents have rights to under FERPA. So the FERPA guidelines, while they were created in 1974, and this does pose us some problems in 2015, how we adopt those regulations to current modern day technology, some of these guidelines are very clear still today. Students and parents do have the right to inspect and review their educational record, prevent disclosure of it by explicitly telling the school for those things that are allowed to be disclosed, seek amendments to the education record if inaccurate, and be notified of those rights. I know one of the things that we do at the department is every year we send an email to all school districts as a reminder of these obligations that they have under FERPA, and that the districts do this as part of their onboarding process for new students as well. And then as programs come on online that could potentially impact this, they also have to notify parents of that. FERPA does allow a level of information to be disclosed without parental consent. This information is what we commonly refer to as directory information and covers some basics: student's name, address, number, date and place of birth, honors awards, and dates of attendance. Schools do have to tell parents which aspects of that information they are disclosing, and the parents can request that that information not be disclosed. I have a star by date and birth because there are some states where privacy laws prohibit date and birth being part of directory information. Oregon is not one of those states. So right now, this is allowable for school districts to disclose without prior consent.
Can I ask, when we talk directory information, can you give me some examples of what that would be?
The most common example is graduation announcement. So under FERPA rules, you're technically not supposed to link student name in any sort of accomplishment or grades. Honors and awards is the exception. So,
in other words, when the newspaper prints all the graduates
yes.
of the high schools. Okay.
Yep.
So, Representative, I'm sorry, Representative
yes.
Frederick.
Yes, thank you very much. There are a couple of things here. You mentioned the rights that parents have.
Mm-hmm.
How long does it usually take for anyone to get information about the student, the records that the district may have or whatever? In talking with parents that I've talked with, it takes a long time to be able to get good information and the ability to correct it if it's wrong. That's one of the concerns that I have.
Yeah. Chair Doherty, Representative Frederick, thank you for the question. It's hard to say. I think it's going to vary from district to district what that timeline is going to be, and I'm not really sure, honestly, what that range is. I know there are a lot of factors that go into what they need to do to get that information out, but we can do a little bit of investigation and kind of get you a range.
If you would, thank you. Follow up. The concern is that it is what is often being said to me is that parents are discouraged from asking any further questions and being told that it's going to take months or that they're going to have to pay for certain things, even though they may not have to. They're being discouraged from even asking that question. So,
yeah, that's definitely something we can follow up on.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Okay, continue.
So for disclosure of information outside of directory information, there are some specific cases where it is allowed. Obviously, when a student is transferring, they're allowed to ship the information school to school. For any health and safety emergencies or public safety emergencies, obviously the legal process, and then accrediting organizations. And then FERPA also allows two specific exemptions for research or program evaluation purposes. So this allows the Department of Education to collect data on students specifically to measure how effective different programs in districts are, how schools are performing. It's also the clause that allows OEIB as well as research institutions to do analysis on student data. Brian will talk a little bit later about specifically how we manage those data sharing agreements because there obviously is a lot of care that has to go into that to make sure that in the course of doing that, we're not disclosing information that we shouldn't. So that covers the rules and regulations. So I'll do kind of a high level on some of the types of data that ODE collects. At a high level for all students, we're collecting a variety of data points on what we commonly refer to as the directory information, so just names, addresses, date of birth, gender and ethnicity, which the students self-declare, courses taken, and that's a high level, days in attendance, and that's really, days in attendance, test scores, and then we have a lot of what we call flags that we just mark basically whether a student it falls into this category. So recently we introduced a collection for freshmen on track because one of the research showed that one of the data points to indicate whether a student was highly probable to graduate was whether they completed freshman year with the requisite credits to be on track for graduation. This is just a yes, no. Each district has their own rules around what the number of credits are. So we didn't ask them to tell us the number. We just said, say yes or no. Are they on track or not? We also collect whether or not the student is homeless, whether they graduate, and then the type of diploma they get. And then there's one that I didn't include in here, which is economically disadvantaged. And so we'll cover that. I mentioned that because we'll cover that when we talk about free and reduced lunch. We also collect discipline incidents, but this is at a high level. We collect just specific kinds. We do collect student-level data on this, but we don't report out. And I know it was a concern that Representative Frederick has raised, which is why I'm calling it out. The only information on discipline that goes outside of the department is aggregate. No student-level data ever leaves ODE in regards to discipline. We do that for a variety of reasons, similar to what I've mentioned before. Discipline, we released a report earlier in the year, which Brian could talk more about, that showed that discipline incidents, when you looked in the lens of ethnicity, there was a disproportionate amount of discipline incidents for certain minorities. And so that kind of evaluation is very helpful for us to start to look and see what types of things at the department we can do to try to address some of these things. We do have some very specific collections around English language learners, very specific around when they're starting the program, when they exit the program as proficient, the types of programs that they're in, core content provided, and then kind of that status. It is also one of an interesting data point that Brian had brought up to us before, that when a student exits the program within a certain amount of time, their likelihood of graduating is significantly higher than any other minority or their equivalent white students as well. So it's very interesting data points to see on this. Free and reduced lunch. So there's some specific, this is an interesting one. It's why I mentioned the economically disadvantaged flag. At a student level, economically disadvantaged is the only data point that we collect that's on the student record. So the districts have to collect for the administration of the program a lot higher level of data, which is some of what I list here. ODE does not collect that data. None of these things are part of our regular data collection or data storage on the student record. The only thing that we are using is kind of that aggregate count, percentage count. That number is used for a variety of other federal programs. It's kind of a poverty measure. There is a program that we engage with the Department of Human Services called Direct Certification, which allows students that are receiving these specific program assistance, TANF, to it links up with free and reduced lunch, so they get additional benefits for free and reduced lunch. We serve as the broker for that, so DHS sends us the list of kids that are qualify. We have the list of students enrolled. We make a match, send that resulting information back to the district. So when I say we don't have any student level data, we're brokering this information, but we're not storing this, and it's not part of the student record. There is a high degree, as you can see here, of number of special education data. I think for obvious reasons, this is a program that we want to be tracking and making sure that the services that these kids need are being met by the districts. And so there's a lot of different elements here in terms of placement, services received, where they're attending, what those disability codes are. This is the one area where we do kind of traipse into HIPAA data. We do get diagnosis codes on these kids so that we can make sure that they're receiving the right types of services from the district. And additional individual programs that these kids are under. So I found it also helpful to kind of talk through what some of the data that we don't collect. So there's a variety of things. When our data collections first started in 2004, we did collect student Social Security numbers. That practice stopped in 2007. We do not have Social Security numbers for any of our students. We also don't collect student grades. There's a few little exceptions here. We do have private schools that have closed. We have all those student records. And then we also broker a transcript exchange between districts. And part of that transcript exchange is the student courses and grades. So it does flow through the system, but like I said, it's not part of the official student record. And it's just allowing districts to be able to exchange that information as students transfer from district to district.
And if we can go back up to the Social Security number, so yes. That second bullet, just those are for adults.
Correct. Yeah. Yes. Yeah, for those specific
Hopefully
programs.
Hopefully you have adult bus drivers.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it would be a little terrifying otherwise. Yeah. And then medical records, we do not collect that except where the diagnosis codes that I previously mentioned. Oh, and I forgot financial records. Yeah, we don't collect any specific detailed financial records on any of our students. And the exception is really at the district level that they do for the administration of free and reduced lunch, but ODE does not collect that data. So access to this data, we take this very seriously and make sure that only those staff whose roles explicitly require them to have access to the data have access. The example I like to use is me. I'm the head of the IT department. I have no access to student data because my role does not require it. It's the same in all of our programs as well. You only have access to the specific program set of data that your role specifically requires. Our research department obviously has access to a higher degree of data because of the function that they perform. And our assessment staff do focus on statewide results, but only in those specific areas regarding statewide assessments. My team does have a level of data that's a little different because of their function, but we've divided it team by team. So our help desk, which is our frontline support, does have access to the student collections because often we have to provide technical support to districts as they're submitting this information. Our security team has access to some specific set of data because they're the ones that respond when there's a legal request, and so they have to have that level of access to comply with those requests. Our database teams who manage all of the infrastructure that stores this data obviously have a level of access as well because of their role. I will just touch on none. Actually, this might be a good spot if you want to jump in, Mr. Reeder. Do you want to cover this?
Sure. For the record, Brian Reeder, Assistant Superintendent in the Office of Research and Data Analysis at the department. In addition to the research that we do in the office, we also provide our data to outside researchers who are interested in assisting with education research in Oregon. We have done that primarily with the universities in Oregon, Oregon State, University of Oregon, Western Oregon University. Recently, we've also provided it to some researchers at Stanford and are in the process of initiating a project with it's an evaluation of Oregon, the impact of Oregon's waiver from No Child Left Behind, a researcher up at the University of Washington. When we provide data to those researchers, we have very strict confidentiality rules, and we also require that that the research they're doing be beneficial to the education community in Oregon. So if they're doing something that's of interest to them but not of great interest to us, then we do not share our data with them. So we have agreements with them. We treat them as contracts, even though it's very rare that money changes hands. We want to have a very good record of the agreement that we have with them, so we do it as an official contract that we run through our contract management system. We also have every researcher or assistant who has any access to the data sign a confidentiality agreement with us. We require that they keep the data on secure servers. We have a start and an end date for their work, and at the when the end date is reached and when their work is finished, we require that they delete the data from their servers and destroy any cases where they've actually printed any of the data on paper.
I was going to say, Representative, refer to the and then what do you guys do? I mean, how do we know that it's been deleted?
We don't know for sure. We have agreements with them. We have not, as far as I know, in any case, showed up at their place of business and tried to verify that they've deleted the data. We have, but we do have those agreements in our contracts.
Thank you,
Madam Chair, I'm following a part of that. What happens if they don't? I mean, what are the ramifications if that data is somehow sold or given away or part of their bankruptcy, and so suddenly you have this as an asset? They now have information that marketers love.
Chair Doherty, Representative Frederick, under our contracts, they are subject to all the requirements of HIPAA and FERPA and so forth. And so if that happens, then they have violated federal law and they can be prosecuted for that.
Okay.
May I follow up?
Mm-hmm.
Has there ever been anyone, as far as I know, there's been no one has ever been prosecuted for violating FERPA. So what is the, I mean, the ramifications for this are almost a paper tiger. It's possible, and yet we have seen breaches on a regular basis for across the country on different bits of information on student information and other information. So we haven't had anyone ever prosecuted with FERPA, as far as I know, unless I'm mistaken on that.
Chair Doherty, Representative Frederick, I don't know whether anyone's ever been prosecuted. I do know that in my 15 years at the Department of Education, we have never had at the department a disclosure of confidential information that I'm aware of.
Okay. You have something. You haven't gotten to this, but it's the second bullet there. The concerns that I've seen have been particularly not necessarily the department, but the individual school districts that have had that kind of a problem or a concern. Not intentionally, by any means, but we had some issues making sure that certain folks were not using student data. When I was with the Portland schools, so these are concerns, and I, as much as you might have a district security administrator at a large district like Portland or North Clackamas or Beaverton or Eugene or Salem, the smaller districts, the district security administrator is probably also the basketball coach, and teaching social studies as well. So I mean, this is a concern of mine.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Madam Chair.
Representative Wilson.
If I could ask just one quick question here, and that is, you mentioned a moment ago that information on kids under disciplinary action are forwarded from the local district to the state, to the department, and you indicated that that was valuable for one reason or another. And I'd like you just to take a few moments to expand on that, and that is, how can the Department of Education help? What can they mitigate by having that information?
Sure. Chair Doherty, Representative Wilson, and I can only speak to what we do in the research office. The primary function of the research office is to do analysis that helps decision makers make better decisions. And in order to do that, we try very hard to understand those influences that affect how well students do in school. And that's a very complicated process. We know that gender affects how well students do in school. We know that there's very strong correlations between ethnicity and school performance. With attendance and school performance. And we also know, we have learned, that students who have more discipline incidents are students who do less well academically and they graduate at lower rates. Our goal is to help policymakers understand those impacts so that they can implement policies that assist those students to ultimately help them do better in school, graduate from high school, and go on with their lives, whether it's higher education or the workforce.
Just one quick follow-up. Then the information that you gather, you use to make determinations on how best to go from this point forward with those students, and I presume that you communicate that information ultimately back to the school districts?
Chair Doherty, Representative Wilson, we distribute our research as widely as we can. We make it available in a number of ways. I work closely with the Quality Education Commission. We release a report every other year. We're also in the process of writing a number of policy papers that look at those factors that influence student achievement and high school graduation. Yeah, we try to make that available as broadly as we can. We don't contact individual school districts and say, this particular student is in these circumstances, you need to help him or her. Mm-hmm. These are what we're looking for, are broad influences that show consistent correlations with either doing well or doing poorly in school, so that the districts and schools can understand the difficulties that certain students face and maybe use that information to design programs to help them.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Okay,
continue. I think I've got one more slide. So this is the last slide. This is the what I affectionately call the technical mumbo-jumbo slide. So there are a variety of things that we do from a technical standpoint to ensure that the data is protected. Without going into a lot of the technical jargon, basically we make sure that that data technically is protected when we have it, when it's in transit. We make sure that none of this data that's being sent to researchers is sent over email. We have secure file transfers to ensure that we provide the maximum protection to that data when we have it, when it's moving to others. And then, like I mentioned, we have a large variety of policies and procedures at the department to ensure that all of the staff understand the, for lack of a better term, the sanctity of this data, make sure that we're not careless with it and how we're using it with all of these tools. And to make sure that they sign off, we have as part of the new employee orientation, they're understanding these rules and that they're signing off on them to ensure that we limit risk of exposure.
Okay, so Representative Reardon has a question.
Two questions. Okay. Is your software as good as Home Depot's?
Hopefully better.
Okay.
Better? Good.
Do you collect data on homeschooled and charter school kids?
Chair Doherty, Representative Reardon, we really don't, as a department, collect data on homeschool kids. But since charter schools are public schools, we essentially have the same type of data for charter school students as we do for other non-charter students in the state.
Okay. Thank you.
Last two of your two.
So I think what's on these last two slides, I think I talked about most of these points already. Just a couple additional points. We at the department are working closely with researchers over at OEIB. They have a different set of expertise than we do in our research office, so we complement each other in that way. So we share our data with them. They are subject to all the same confidentiality restrictions and rules that ODE employees are. They are very careful with the data, just as we are. And we also, in recent years, have looked into sharing data with Department of Human Services to benefit both organizations, understanding sort of the health backgrounds of students. Is a useful tool in which we find that it does have an influence on their experiences in school. And the health department, I think there's some evidence to show that school experiences also have an impact on health. So we're cooperating with them. We're in the early stages of that, but we see some fruitful learning to be done there and that will help both improve educational outcomes and health outcomes for Oregon's young people. And we will, both organizations have a lot of experience in maintaining and using confidential data, and so we're confident that we can share that data without any difficulties.
So really the last two slides are just kind of representative of some of the policies and procedures that I mentioned earlier. I won't go through them in detail, but just put them on here to kind of give you an example of the types of things that we do make sure that we cover with all of our employees so that they understand all of the different aspects of how they're going to come in contact with the data, how they use that, how we ensure by different reviews that they're accessing and using that data appropriately, and how we handle a variety of different scenarios.
And I would assume if anyone wants these policies, they can contact you.
Correct. That is all we have to present. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Any questions? Representative Reardon.
excuse me. There used to be, when I was in high school, kind of an issue around student safety and protecting their data versus the safety of perhaps the teacher and the other members of that class. And I know there were limits on what information could be given to the teacher. So, you know, he or she might mm-hmm. end up with a kid in class that had a violent history. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that at all, or is that some other discussion that...
So most of that is going to be handled district by district, and so the answer is going to vary a little bit. Most districts employ what's called a student information system, which is their version of kind of the data that we collect. So they have, and they have significantly more data, obviously, on the kids. I know that they do have different codes to use that they put into that SIS for discipline incidents, which would then help them know how to help the kid. What I honestly don't know is how much of that data is available to teachers. That's something we could follow up on.
It was quite a topic of discussion at various times.
Mm-hmm. Well, just a follow-up just from my experiences. There were some districts that actually we bargained that, and we had we knew, for example, if a student had been through the juvenile justice system for arson, for example, so we wouldn't put the child next to flammable things or whatever, and it was more kind of on a confidential, very, very confidential, but at least to make sure that in the classrooms we could adapt so the child wouldn't be harmed or tempted or something like that. So, yeah. Representative Frederick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am concerned as well about the ability to triangulate the data. You mentioned the DHS situation. It might be possible with all of the different data sources, it's possible to find out, despite the efforts of you not saying this is this particular child, but if that particular child happens to be a free and reduced lunch, is also in a housing program, you could easily come down to the name of those of that particular kid by just triangulating the data, not necessarily coming straight from ODE, but it's still this is a concern that I keep hearing about as well.
Chair Doherty, Representative Frederick, and we share that concern. And the data that we share with, student-level data that we share with other organizations is used exclusively for analysis, internal analysis. And we never publish, we almost never publish the sort of extracts of data sets or aggregates of data sets that we use for research that involves student-level data in a way that would allow that kind of triangulation. I mean, the big concern we have when we release, for example, district-level data broken down by ethnicity or by special ed status is that in a particular district or school in a particular category of student that there will be only a few students. And so our rule is if there are five or fewer students, we don't publish that data. When we do research that involves data sharing, we almost never break those data down by district in a form where we end up publishing it.
I'm not suggesting that you intentionally publish this. I am just concerned about whether we are tracking, whether other folks are able to use that so that they can, in fact, triangulate it. It's not that I'm saying that ODE is publishing this, but it's just we have so much data out there that it's just it's hard to track how people are using it, and that's the concern that I have. Mm-hmm.
Because I know that there are some other there's a bill coming in from the Senate that deals with private sector and this kind of thing. So just because so many of the, if you haven't been at school lately, so many of the kids have programs on iPads that are, it's built for this child and that child and this child, and they're through Google and Apple and some of these others. So I know that's something like that. There is a bill on the Senate side that deals with that. We'll be hearing it probably.
Very likely.
Okay. Any other questions of the panel? Okay, thank you very much for the information. So with that, I close the informational hearing on student data and open up the concurrent public hearing on House Bill 2709, 2710, 2711, and 2712. Okay, Representative Frederick, and we're going to try to very nicely summarize all four bills.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. All four of these bills are bills relating to student records and privacy. There is.
Yeah.
I think that's a record, actually.
Richard is very good at synthesizing things. Or we could have spent the next 20 minutes talking more about them, but Representative Frederick will. Thank you very
thank
much.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I will not be as brief as Richard on this, but I will talk. I want to talk about these four bills. I'm Lou Frederick, House District 43 North in Northeast Portland. I'm also a member of the Ways and Means Subcommittee on Information Technology, where we got an excellent presentation on related issues yesterday from Alex Pettit. And he's the Oregon State Chief Information Officer, by the way. Last summer and fall, along with a number of people, including Peter Tromba, Policy and Research Director at OEIB, we convened a student data privacy work group to take a deeper look at these issues than was possible during the short session last year. And I was going to bring down a little my three-ring binder, and I completely forgot to carry it with me. But it's there. Thank you. This was the report. Thank you very much. This, if you'd like to look at this, I'm more than willing to show it. I'm sure we can get copies of it if you'd like to see it. But this was done by Peter Tromba and the OEIB folks. They did an outstanding job of putting together information about what issues regarding student privacy were out there. What was also interesting was that every couple of days there was a new article to add to this packet of information. And that has continued. So I want to thank you for hearing these four bills. I've been working on this issue for several years, and I want to start out, as I often do, by outlining the questions I think we should be asking and what our priorities ought to be. First, I think we should recognize that technology is running way ahead of policy when it comes to recording, archiving, and potentially publishing a lot about our lives that we'd like to think we control access to. For our children, the decisions we make here can have profound effects on their lives decades from now. I first read Orwell's 1984 when it was a cautionary tale about the future. What will it be to our children, our children's children, and beyond? For those of us who grew up in an era of paper records, and most of us, I think, grew up in an era of paper records, what we did a long time ago is the stuff of reminiscing at reunions, behavior that we like to think we grew out of. Well, we can forget about it if we want to because the records are gone. I think that's good in my case. Part of growing up is reinventing oneself, and we had that opportunity. The fundamental question is, who owns a person's story? Put another way, who has sovereignty over a person's story? Now, the capacity exists to record everything from test scores to keystrokes to behavior notes and to transmit that to the cloud, which really means to servers somewhere. And the only thing that stands between those records and marketers, recruiters, future employers, or admissions officers, or just curious eyes, is a combination of the regulations we put in place and the goodwill of the custodians of those records. We should not rely too heavily on the latter, in my view. Personal information about human beings is the currency of the 21st century. There are entities out there that know how to mine that gold. If we fail to put ethical boundaries on the collection, retention, protection, and use of that data, the only justification those entities need to use is need to use it as they wish is because we can. So I think we should take a hard look at the risks associated with extending the electronic frontier into schools. That does not mean I think we should revert to paper records. It does mean I think that we should be careful. I had a disturbing discussion a few years ago in my office in which I was told that protections I was proposing would endanger the longitudinal study. I said, isn't that backwards? The doors into our children's lives that are being opened through electronic records cannot be easily closed. So I think that we should be asking both, what are the benefits of the new data systems and what are the risks? And the first question should include benefit for whom? To reveal my bias here, I do not believe that we should inflict risks on our young people for benefits that will not be theirs. Now, the justifications often cite the benefit of creating a resource for future research. But thinking back to our hearing on Monday, there is some question as to the quality of the data we are gathering to inform that research. The risks to our students are the same whether we forward those future researchers valid measurements of student progress or just a lot of numbers. A longitudinal study is not valuable by the sheer fact that it is longitudinal. In fact, an investment in a longitudinal study can lead to a durable attachment to data, even if, as it's shown, to be invalid. Now is the time to question those premises because we really haven't done so yet. The risks are the same whether researchers are rigorous in their examination of the data and the conclusions they draw, or sloppy or limited by politics. The risks are the same whether policymakers are rigorous in their application of those conclusions, or take some implications of the research off the table. For example, if future research tells us, as prior research has, that poverty is a major barrier to educational achievement, if it tells us that a richer, more comprehensive, and potentially more expensive program is the key to closing the so-called achievement gap, and we are unwilling to act on that information, then what would be the point of the research? Meanwhile, if we are not careful, our children may find themselves pretty much stripped of all rights to control their own information, information that is already housed and controlled elsewhere. And this is not just an Oregon problem. Hearings are taking place in Congress right now regarding potentially updating the Family Education Rights and Privacy Act, FERPA, to reflect technological advances that were not anticipated when it was passed. We should note that we have much more stringent rules for research involving our physical bodies than we do for potential risks to our identities, our personal information, our histories, our stories. Each of these bills comes at these issues in a somewhat different way. House Bill 2709 establishes expectations as to the rights of parents, legal guardians, and students to know what is contained in a student's record and how it may be used. House Bill 2710 requires a privacy risk assessment of data systems, programs, or contracts that involve student records. HB 2711 establishes standards for how personally identifiable student information may be handled, used, and retained. The aim is to confirm that the goal in gathering and maintaining such records is to support educational goals. External goals should be secondary if they increase the personal risk for our students. HB 2712 calls for civil penalties to be established for violations of rules regarding the creation, use, custody, and disclosure of student records. So to recap, the issues are 1, sovereignty, who owns this information, 2, security, what is the risk that could be used in a way that violates that sovereignty or causes harm in the future. Number 3, standards. How will we evaluate proposals to collect, store, and access student records? 4, quality. If this data is to inform future research, will that research be informed by valid information? And 5, teeth. The regulations we put in place have to have some enforcement mechanism behind them. I'm reminded of a passage in Beverly Cleary's Ramona Quimby, age 8. I don't know if you read that or whether you read that to your kids or not. I hope so. She says, "Daddy, what are you studying?" "I'm studying the cognitive processes of children." "What does that mean?" "How kids think." Ramona did not like the sound of this subject at all. "Why are you studying that?" she demanded. "Some things should be private, and how children thought was one of them." She did not like the idea of grown-ups snooping around in thick books trying to find out. "Well, I don't think you should," said Ramona. "It's none of your business how kids think." My point is, what boundaries are we willing to breach or allow others to breach when it comes to our children's lives and stories? Where will it stop? Momentous societal change is being driven by vendors. Policymakers need to take charge. I hope future generations will be able to rely on some level of control over their personal information, that we will protect their sovereignty over their identities, their stories, the selves that they are creating. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Are there any questions of Representative Frederick? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, we have a couple of people testifying on one or all of the bills. Lisa Schultz and Chris Ullman.
Yeah.
make sure you identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon, Chair Doherty and committee members. My name is Lisa Schultz. By background, I've submitted some written testimony on all four bills. Mm-hmm. My background is I have a master's degree in science and electrical engineering. I have worked in the high-tech industry here in Oregon for over 30 years, and I'm a former member of the Beaverton School Board and the very proud mother of a 2012 graduate from the Beaverton School District. I became interested in data privacy several years ago based on some constituent issues when I was on the school board, and after I left, I continued to look into them. I then testified in 2013 on Senate Bill 567, and Representative Frederick, you may have to help me here. It was HB 2666, I believe, your first bill. And then in the 2014, Representative Frederick sponsored House Bill 4062.
I think that's right.
Anyway, so I've done this before, so hopefully the information that I've provided for you, I've tried to. I know this is a very tough subject. It is both technically complex and legally complex, so I've tried to make my testimony as clear as I possibly could, and I'm happy to answer any questions that you have. And if you don't have any, I have a couple clarifying points that I could make. So
you could do that, because all of the testimony is on OLIS. In fact, there were quite a few submissions, and so they're all on OLIS for the record. But if you'd like to bring up your points, that would be great.
Okay. First, thank you very much to Representative Frederick. He's really led the way on this, and I've been listening and making sure following his testimony, and he's done an excellent job of, I think, much better than I could, of linking all of these issues together. So I want to thank him very much for taking the lead on this. So I won't be as eloquent as he is, but here's a couple of points. One is the issue of privacy versus security is often confused. And security is the technical issues around just making sure that data is safe. But this legislation, and I think what Representative Frederick gets to the heart of, is data privacy. Privacy is a fundamental human right recognized in the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, and in many other international and regional treaties. Privacy underpins human dignity and other key values such as freedom of association and freedom of speech. It has become one of the most important human rights issues of the modern age. And basically, it's about, do we get to control our data? That is the privacy question. There are established frameworks for data privacy. I know for many of us, the technological revolution caught many people by surprise, but long ago, when computers and data were first coming into being, there were frameworks. One of those from, I believe, 1974 is the Code of Fair Information Practices. I've provided a link to that to you in my testimony. The Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development has guidelines for privacy. The United States is an OECD country, and so we should be adhering to those guidelines. Also, the Electronic Privacy and Information Center has developed what they call a Student Privacy Bill of Rights, and I've forwarded that to you as well. So I would think of this issue as an evolving situation, and I think the place that we are at is much like where we were at the turn of the last century with the automobile. When cars first came into being, we didn't have much in the way of safety rules, regulations. And if you look at automobiles today, it's an incredibly regulated industry. We love cars, but we probably wouldn't like it if anybody could put any old piece of machinery out on the marketplace that wasn't safe, or you could just drive across your neighbor's lawn because it was the quickest way to get somewhere. So I think of that's where we're at right now in terms of information technology, is we are at the beginning of setting that framework of privacy and security so that our children, many years from now, will be safe. And that is the point that Intel's director of global director of privacy made, is that if children are going to be free to learn in the 21st century, and they should be, I hope we all agree, then we are going to have to work very hard to create this network of privacy and security. So if you have any specific questions, I'd be happy to answer. I could go on for, you know, a long time. But,
well, I think what we'll do is we'll hear from the rest of the panel, and then we'll ask you questions. Okay. And open it up.
For the record, Chair Doherty, my name is Chris Allman. Again, I've submitted a lot of testimony. I'm certainly not going to talk about it all. What I do want to do is start out with my story, why this is important to me. First of all, it's hard for me to come down here on a repetitive basis because I feel like I've been Cassandra. I've been concerned about data privacy for about 3.5 years. And every time I get discouraged, there are certain gut punches that come my way. This past March, it came by way of trying to file my taxes. We had identity theft. It's not fun. And so, in any case, I'm a physician, and as you can well imagine, I value data. I think it's important to use data with what we do in our decision making, but it's part of the big picture of how we evaluate anything. And I've been very involved in that role in school districts, in Beaverton School District specifically. I've been on site councils for Montclair, and the last one was for the Arts and Communication Magnet Academy. In fact, the shoes that I filled were Suzanne Bonamici's. She preceded me in that role. The first time I started thinking about this issue was when I went to a then OEIT meeting. It was before they became a board. They were just still a team. And I heard of Project Alder. And I asked myself, what is this? And it made me concerned because it was a big database that I knew nothing about. Now, granted, it wasn't a secret database because I was able to get on the website and learn a whole lot about Project Alder. And as I started looking at the grants, as I started looking at all the data that was being shared, I became alarmed because I wondered, wait a minute, how is this happening? And then I did something that was perhaps unprecedented for the rest of the United States. I know it was for Oregon. I asked for my son's state longitudinal data system records. Now, this was right before he was turning 18. And so I had to get done quickly. But I researched the law, and I forwarded my information to the Department of Ed. And I have to say, I was very pleased with the response. They were very quick in sending me a CD with a slew of information. And I looked at this information. It was hard to analyze because it was a lot of codes. But what I was able to do after I was looking at all the file formats and whatnot is I determined that somehow my son was miscoded as a dropout for 4 times. Now, this gets at the question of data quality and the consequences that may come about when decisions are made based on wrong data. But the other thing that was problematic is that data could not be corrected. And the way that I tried to go about this question is I asked both at the state level what the data they had, and then our district went through their state student information system, which is something we've touched on a little bit in hearing about, and which we hear from Ben Tate has lots more information. And it's in those regards, as I started looking at the potential of data that could be put into these databases with what is called the Common Education Data Standards. You might take a look at version 5. It's amazing how much potential data could be put into our students' records. So Lisa mentioned the fair information practices. And one of the things that I think is important to understand is that the openness principle is exactly that. Is this a secret, or the whole idea of whether or not there is a secret database? Now, again, the question isn't so much is it secret or not, because it could be on the public record. If it's maintained at the state, it's one thing. But ever since 2008 in particular, by virtue of FERPA changes, information has been outsourced to private vendors. So we're talking about a problem where we can't find out if, in fact, data has been eliminated, as we've already heard, not to mention what it is they do to repurpose the data. And I talked about, in specific, Pearson. Pearson has a subsidiary where school districts are now going to, where they can both score and store all the tests that are done for students who are on IEPs or getting 504s. I think about that. I think about the overlap in HIPAA. And I'm so alarmed because with HIPAA, we had the rule changes in 2002, 6 years preceding the 2008 rule changes that increased the way that data was being shared without permission. So I look at that and I look at the 80,000 or 80 million that is people who have been affected by the Anthem data breach. And then I start really getting my gears spinning because school districts are now using school-based health centers. They want to use telemedicine. Telemedicine has a huge HIPAA security flaw. The way that it's teleconferenced is not even covered by the HIPAA security rule.
Now, are these things that we use, or are you just concerned about the future, or?
Yeah, the future. The rules are being considered with Senate Bill 144, and I brought this testimony forward. It gets to the question has been talked about, that technology is racing so much further ahead than what policy can keep up with. So when I think about this constellation of issues, I think about it in the context of what all of us can be facing, not only with our identity theft, but with our kids' identity theft. And lastly, I wanted to point out that there is precedence with what HIPAA has been put into place in terms of how auditing and enforcement is done. I have that in my last testimony. It's through the Office of Civil Rights, and there's a process by which it's enforced.
I got that.
But I do want to point out that, you know, as we're thinking about this, governments, schools, they're not immune. So it's that much more important as you think about this, that this is our children's posterity that we are trying to protect, and we need to really slow down this train and think very hard about how we make the right decisions.
Okay, thank you. Any questions of the panelists? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We had Ben Tate and Joe Morlock. Do you guys still want to come back up, or? Okay. And then we have last three that.
Chair Doherty and the committee, once again, my name is Ben Tate. I'm the Chief Information Officer for the Oregon Department of Education. I share Representative Frederick's concerns about policy and technology and the pace that both have taken over the last 5 years, especially. The technological change in the past 5 years has just been astounding. I don't think any of us saw the consumerization of technology or how quickly the smartphone and tablet would really revolutionize what we did after we did it. I think in terms of student data in particular, since the majority of these people cannot advocate for themselves, we do need to be very thoughtful. We need to be very considerate. We need to be very careful in how we approach this and the measures we take. I think this is definitely a matter that we need to spend some time looking at, and I appreciate Representative Frederick's efforts to raise awareness of these issues. I do have a few concerns around some of the language of some of the bills, specifically just around some of what I think would be unintended consequences. And so I have submitted written testimony. I'll just highlight a few of those things.
Thank you. Because we've got it here.
Yeah. In 2710, my large concern really comes down to, I think, as Representative Frederick has stated, none of the things that happen at a district level happen with malicious intent. I think people are just unaware of how the technology can potentially impact what they are doing and the risks that are associated. So I would advocate for more of a proactive approach rather than a reactive approach, and I would love to see the Department of Education take a role in helping to educate districts, provide them sample contracts, provide them sample structures, and be there as a resource to be able to provide them help, especially those smaller districts, which will do struggle in being able to devote people time to these issues. The scope of this bill is very broad. I think in order to adequately do an audit of all of these systems, it would take quite a bit of people in order to do it. We estimated on average there's probably 20 to 40 things that fall under the category of contracts, programs, and systems that touch student data that would need to be audited. And with the rapid rate of technical change, it really would be kind of a never-ending cycle in order to go through, which is why I would like to see a more of a proactive approach. On 2711, I think the big concern for me is around treading that line to ensure that we treat the data correctly without without purging it unnecessarily. We do have a lot of people that come to districts after they've graduated, sometimes a long time after they've graduated, requesting their student information for a variety of reasons. So I think there is a balance there between allowing people to do what they need to do with their information, because it is theirs, but not having a blanket statement that may lead to harm, you know, for them down the road. On 2712, my concern really is just around understanding a little bit more what kind of the logistics would be. Is ODE supposed to take the role of determining guilt for FERPA violations and imposing the fines? You know, what's the appeal process? You know, what are some of those pieces? This is a territory that we have not gone into. ODE does not impose fines for any of their programs right now. So this just to kind of help better understand some of those things. I think all of my concerns are definitely things that we can work on. We've had, I think, very fruitful conversations with Representative Frederick, and I'm definitely looking forward to continuing those conversations to find the right balance here to protect our student data without causing any unintended consequences.
Okay, thank you. Yeah, Mr. Morlock, would you like to?
And for the record, thank you, Representative Chairwoman Dougherty, members of the committee. My name is Joe Morlock. I'm the Executive Director of Secondary Programs and Technology for the Lake Oswego School District. And I thought I would just share a bit of a district's perspective on the range of bills and also answer any questions that you might have specific to districts. When we talk about data privacy in school districts, we take it exceptionally seriously. People send us every day their most important resource, which is their child, the most important thing in their lives. They send to us, and our job is to protect them and all of information about them as carefully as possible. We do collect information on students. When student parents register, tell us who should be able to pick them up, who shouldn't be able to pick them up. Do they have a bee sting allergy or not? Do they have other special circumstances? Do they want their information released to the military, for instance, if they're in high school? So we have a lot of information that we collect every year from that. And along with that, we also provide them an annual notice and a process by which they can get their data and they can also change it. I know every district is a little bit different, but that process is in place. We have policies, and it's a fairly easy process to do it at each school. We only allow people certain levels of information access based upon their role. So it has to do with the educational interest of the child. We have several things within our student information system. For instance, whether or not they're a special education student. Not everybody who works in the district gets to know that. Only the folks who have a specific educational interest about that child. We have very specific data rules based upon roles, and we have somebody who manages that and can turn on and off access. Somebody changes a job from one place to another one. We turn off their access from the old and turn on their access to the new. And we spend a lot of time trying to make sure that all the folks who have access to only what they need. That can frustrate people. So sometimes I get a little bit of heat from the high school principal or a middle school principal that says, well, I need to know this. And we have to say, I'm sorry, that's not in your direct educational interest, and so we can't share that with you. But we have these battles every day about who can know what and what's the most important thing and what's that that layer of access they should have. We do follow very closely the rules of FERPA. We're very aware of them all the time. When it was built in 1974, and I think it's still true today, the main thrust of FERPA was to make sure that people had access to their educational record. So you couldn't hold back their grades because they hadn't paid the $1.50 fine to the school library. You know, we joke about that, but it's true. You know, people would be denied access to their child's records. We also have to have certain protections in place when we have custody battles. It happens all the time where one parent says the other parent can't pick up the child because of whatever reason. And so we're constantly walking that line about who can get those and who cannot. But again, I would say that we're very serious about those. For student benefit, when we start looking at longitudinal data and how's the student doing, we're looking into something called like an early warning system. So we can tell whether or not we need to provide better access or, support for a student, certain child who's not reading well. We know the research says that by the time they get to third grade, if they're not reading at grade level, they're at a much lower percentage for graduating. And then it's even more so true, and maybe double that, if they're students from poverty. And so we're trying to find ways for us to be able to have an early warning along the way. Is this child making it? Are they not? Are they struggling in math? Is that true? Then which part of math? And so we use some of that data for us to be able to adjust our system. You know, we're working on a 13-year project. Every year we start a new one, a new set of 13-year projects. And every one of them comes to us differently. Different resources, different raw materials, different ways to learn, different abilities. And so the challenge is for us to continually figure out what intervention is going to work for every child. And I'll tell you what, it's really hard. It's what we do, and we enjoy doing it. But without access to certain kinds of achievement data or ways that children are achieving, we're not going to be able to provide that best education for them. That's why we use it. We try to find out how they're doing. What can we apply? And then 2 or 3 or 4 or 8 years later, did that work? What we applied in second grade, did that help them in eighth grade? Did that help them achieve better? Did our graduation rates increase because we made a change in the way that we operated? Well, we have to keep some of that data to do that. We look at HIPAA came up a few times. I thought we would talk a little bit about that too. I don't even have access to that. We have district level nurses. We don't any longer have school nurses. That's taken care of by the secretary of the building. But those are in cabinets that he or she has locked, and they have special color folders, and they're fireproof file cabinets, and they're in a specific place, and only she or he has access and will provide that information. Occasionally, though, it's really important for that teacher at the school to know that one of their students has a bee sting allergy or a peanut allergy or whatever those things are. Those are important pieces. So the tightrope is to not tell everybody in the world that one child's allergic to bee sting. However, the teacher who's there or the substitute teacher or the recess assistant, should they know those pieces of information? We don't just give them out all the time. It's really interesting how many times per day we actually have an argument about who can get data and who can't. We get requests from our partners at the Oregon Department of Ed. We will often tell them no. And then we'll have an argument about what they can have and what they can't have. And so we have those conversations on a statewide level often. When it comes to things like free and reduced lunch program, that's where the biggest frustration from some of our school people come, because we don't allow them to have all that information. And that is one of the biggest battles. Well, how do I know who the kids are most in need, who need that help? And so, well, we're going to have to help you figure that out, but we can't give you that information. We protect that one as we protect other records in a slightly different way. As far as keeping the records over time, I can't tell you how many people have come back and asked the district, hey, I went here in 1952. Do you have my record? Because I have to prove that I lived here for this certain period of time because of custody or taxes or immigration.
Okay, so we did have a permanent record. Remember some of you old...
So for those of you who may be misbehaving, you thought it was gone because it was on paper, it is not. I assure you we have it. And we do, and we're trying to figure out. You know, we have archivist rules around that, too. Oh, okay. How long we keep these for? 99 years for some of these items. It's a long time. It's a staggering thing to think about how we're going
I'm
to store
trouble now.
This information.
I'd request the chair be a little more careful with the word old.
More mature and experienced.
I just chose a year out of the air. I didn't really mean 1952 for anybody. So, at any rate, I just thought that would be important to note. And then finally, we, for things like 2712, we actually think it's more important to not add layers. We should follow the federal policy. We follow it very carefully. We also go to workshops, lawfully managing student records. I mean, it's a dry morning to go through 4 hours of this, but we do these often. We go to conferences, we go to sessions, we go to things provided around the state and around the country to make sure that we're doing this correctly. We have teams that argue about it among districts and within districts. And so student data privacy is exceptionally important for all of us, and I appreciate the efforts that you folks are putting together, but I thought maybe I'd allow some time for questions if you have that as well.
Are there any questions? Representative McLean.
Well, first of all, I mean, you're not the problem, okay? And the Department of Education is not necessarily the problem, right? Okay, you guys aren't the problem. You guys are the good guys, all right? But the situation is I was really taken by some of the things you just said. It's the idea that we don't know what is in the future as far as technology and the other people actually figuring out how to use the, you know, the data or the data or whatever you want to call it, the records, the personal information, the information that belongs to other people besides you two. And I think I really respect the fact that what this series of bills are trying to do is, if you look at the titles even, first of all is make sure we do have a student rights standard, that the students' rights and the parents' rights are really as current as the technology is. And then secondly, you've got the situation where you're going to actually do a privacy risk assessment, and that doesn't mean this particular, I don't know if I want you to do it. I don't know if, you know, the individual school districts should be doing it, but we need to talk about the risk assessment. After the risk assessment, we can decide on what are we trying to find out. And then you look at the other two, and it's basically, you know, identifying again that technology is going so fast, like you said, that we need to make sure that we're keeping up with trying to keep the protection that we know is important, that the federal government knows is important, and that we're just trying to make sure we're keeping up with it all. And as far as the penalties, I mean, I think that's something that, you know, would definitely be discussed, and certainly there's some amendments that could happen there. But I think what you said and this whole last panel, what I felt was, is as a person who doesn't have a really good, I'll never be somebody you have to worry about, right? I don't know how to, you know, get in there and figure out how to take out something that's not mine or use something that is basically, you know, been sold to me or given to me and have other people try to get it from them. I mean, we're talking about technology and about some of the system problems or some of the system opportunities because of more technology that's coming. So there's no bad guy here. There's no good guy other than, you know, we know you're doing your job. So you're good guys that way. But it's just the fact that we really need to think about, you know, and I really love the fact that you talked about, what was it,
1984?
We're so far beyond that now that we really do have to realize we're in a new age, and we want to protect our kids. So I think that's, everybody's got the same goal. We just have to figure out how to do
it. How to get there. Okay, other comments, questions? Okay, thank you very much for the input. Very, very helpful. Okay, we have three more people on the list, Lori Wimmer, Dana Richardson, and Betty Reynolds. Thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair and committee members. For your record, Lori Wimmer representing 42,000 teachers and community college faculty and classified staff at Oregon's public schools and community colleges. Here today in support of all four of the bills in front of you. I had the honor of being a member of the data privacy work group with some of you, and we heard a lot of great testimony today and also in that work group about the challenges for protecting our students. And I'd like to thank especially Representative Frederick for his leadership on this issue for some time now and his concerns and trying to do this right and get it right. We all hope that we can do that together. I think that sometimes when we think about data management and unauthorized access to data, we tend to think of the sophisticated syndicates that might be able to do something nefarious with all that information, either for profit or for something else. And I'd like to tell you a story about my 14-year-old's middle school. He is now an eighth grader, but last year when he was in seventh grade, one of his classmates decided that selling unauthorized candy bars in the back hall was just not profitable enough. And so he moved into hacking into the data system for his school, which is the Synergy system used by approximately two-thirds of the school districts in this state. And he found a way for a small fee to make a fair amount of money changing grades of his classmates, and that was a very lucrative activity until he was expelled. But
creative.
Yes, very creative. And so I think that we need to think small and large at the same time as we think about about data breaches and how we protect students from any sort of entrepreneurial activity or otherwise. It's also wonderful to see a clarification that student data privacy is owned by the student, not by the state. I think that's very important as we think about this down the road. It's not a sophisticated technology question. It's a principle. It's a value. And for these reasons, so we thank you in advance for your concern over these bills, and we hope that you will pass all four to the floor. Do pass. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. Okay, next.
Good afternoon, members of the committee. Chair Doherty, for the record, my name is Dana Richardson. I'm the Deputy Director for the Higher Education Coordinating Commission, the HEC.
The HEC.
I'm here today to speak specifically to House Bill 2711. And to the extent that there are post-secondary agencies that interact with K through 12 and receive data from them, there are implications in that bill for the HEC, the OEIB, the Community Colleges and Workforce Development Department, and then the Office of Student Access and Completion. And essentially, the implications are due to the wording in Section 1.1b that would indicate that the information can only be provided to those that are directly responsible for student education. So these entities aren't. So there wouldn't be the sharing of data with these entities anymore. So that would reflect in things with regard to reporting on key performance measures for our agency or completing reports like the Minority Teacher Act report, meeting other federal requirements, and of course doing research into data, as you've heard already. Particularly with regard to the Office of Student Access and Completion that administers our student aid programs, they're the federally designated agency to receive this type of data through the free application for federal student aid, the FAFSA. So they are responsible in that role, and as drafted, the bill would preclude them from fulfilling that duty and administering the Opportunity Grant and other scholarship programs to new high school graduates. It would also prevent them from continuing work to do outreach to high school students to help them complete the FAFSA and kind of navigate the admission process. So those are just some things we wanted to bring to your attention, but we are certainly happy to work with the committee and the sponsor to address any of these issues.
Madam
Thank you.
Chair, this is really direct to what she just said. Can I ask
yes.
a question? I'm looking at that very section right now, B, but then I look at C, and the connection between B and C seem very strong to me as far as making sure you're following federal laws, state laws, and also, you know, I mean, and under that, I think covers some of the things that you just talked about as far as opportunities for students. Do you not see the relationship, or is there still a problem if you're looking at B and C together?
I do think there are still possible implications.
Okay.
But this helps moderate, the section C does moderate it.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Betty Reynolds. I'm Vice President for Legislation for Oregon PTA, and I had the pleasure of serving on the work group that Representative Frederick mentioned that he and the Oregon Education Investment Board convened. And Oregon PTA appreciated that its voice was considered in this issue that is so important for parents and for students. The diversity and the quality of the viewpoints considered by the work group, including the expertise of Oregon Education Investment Board, the Oregon Department of Ed, the Department of Justice, contributed to the high quality of input on Representative Frederick's bills. Oregon PTA and National PTA support safeguarding student data through such provisions as third-party vendor restrictions on commercial use of the data, and striving to provide parent engagement in the use of data such as parental notification and choice. So I'd just like to thank you, members of the committee, Representative Frederick, and the Oregon Education Investment Board for your leadership in this very important issue. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Okay, any questions of the panelists? Okay, that's all we have signed up. Anybody else would like to speak on 09, 010, 011, 012? Okay. I think that with this, we were talking earlier with our note was sent to Representative Frederick that possibly we can all get together. There were some concerns that were brought up and come up with a consensus bill that deals with a very serious issue. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am really encouraged. I was encouraged by the work group. I'm encouraged by the comments today. I think there's a way for us to work through some things, and everyone has the same basic concern. It's just a matter of just getting the language so that it does not create problem other problems, and I think we can do that. I'm very, very encouraged by this, so thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, anything else on this one? Okay, with that, I close the public hearing on House Bill 2009 or 2709, 2710, 2711, and 2712. Okay, anything else for the good of the order? It's been a long week, and hopefully some of you will be able to get home this weekend. We don't have any. So anyway, okay, that's it. With that, I adjourn the House Committee on Ed.
Thank you. Thank you.